Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
It was the best of times. It was the worst.
She was the people's princess.
She'll fight on the beaches.
Away, man. These are the things that made England.
She'll fight on the landing ground.
These are the things that made England.
I have the body but of a weak and feeble woman.
These are the things that made England.
And a king of England, too.
These are the things that made England.
Cry God for Harry!
And these are the things that made England.
England! And St. George!
These are the things before made England.
Oh, of course you've heard that Stanley's died because you've responded.
Stanley, God, yes. What he did. What were your Stanley superhero when you were a lad?
When I was a lad.
You were a lad, were you?
Well, yeah, I was once.
A long time ago, yeah, Peter, isn't it?
All the classic ones. So
all the classic ones.
I massively fell in love with Captain America, which had nothing to do with the fact that he had the flag or as a uniform, and everything to do with the fact that he wasn't massively powered,
right?
But he was smart, so he led the Avengers like he was, you know, Mr. Strategic Thinking and stuff.
Right.
So I loved all of that. Loved reading the first episode, the first like 10 episodes of Spider-Man. Are just utter classics, and it's the real Marvel tropes in terms of here is somebody who is powered but has massive personal issues. You know, he can't get a girlfriend. He lives with his aunt and his uncle. He's a geek. He's an outsider, and it's totally that classic thing which you didn't really understand as a kid, but you understood as a teenager and definitely as an adult that. All of Stan Lee's stories are about you feeling like you don't fit in. That's what it's all about.
People say that quite a lot, but I never thought it was like that.
Oh, gosh, they completely are. And that's what the X-Men are all about.
I suppose they're all a bit odd, aren't they?
The whole thing about the X-Men, which I only learnt this about a year ago or so, was that the model for the X-Men between Professor X and Magneto is Martin Luther King and Malcolm X. That's who they are.
Is that right?
Yeah. You know, that Martin Luther King.
Who's ever said, has Stanley said this then? Or is this?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It isn't just some, you know, some academic looking back that he says the mod. So, you know, and it makes complete sense. Professor X is these people are, you know, different, other, the mutants.
Right.
And we want to cooperate with humanity. And he fights constantly this fight with humanity not accepting them, even though he wants to cooperate with them. And Magneto just goes, they don't like us and whatever. Let's just go do our own thing.
Yeah.
And the model was that. And that's the genius of just kind of what he did. That actually massively ate.
So you like them all? You like them all rather than going for a particular one?
Well, to be honest with you, after saying that, I was never crazy about the mutants. There was something about an ordinary person wandering down the road and then a lightning bolt hits them and they have superpowers. There's something about that which is very simple and actually I quite liked. And then them doing daring do's to rescue people. Daredevil, David. Daredevil is a total pest because, again, if there's anything that really turns me on about superheroes, it's be as underpowered as possible. So you've got to think. And Daredevil, it just has heightened senses.
It's Daredevil for you then.
Daredevil is definitely a big love of mine.
Well, in popular choice, as I said, I was always either Iron Man or Spidey.
You know, Iron Man never did it for me.
I liked Iron Man.
Though, when they layered on the alcoholism in the early 80s, he became more interesting.
Oh, tiresome. Who wants superheroes with personal problems?
Well, you're a DC fan. If you don't want that, you're DC all the way, mate.
Name me some DC characters.
Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Green Lantern, Flash.
Ah, they were boring. Batman was interesting by the films, wasn't he? He was rubbish before that. No. I didn't want imperfections. I want really cool guys doing cool things. I don't care about otherness or feeling out of it or, you know, having real problems. Sod that. I wanted him to get Gwen Tracy and, you know, have a good time with MJ and go and beat all the baddies.
Listen, you actually did give this stuff a cursory glance, didn't you? Because you mentioned Gwen.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'd go down to the newsagent and hang around and get them. So I'd get Spidey and I would get Beano. I was slightly in love with Beryl the Peril, to be honest. I mean, who isn't in love with Beryl?
You know what? That says so much about you that you were in love with Beryl the Peril.
Does it say then really, really cool? Okay, let's move on then. So we're paying our respects to Stanley. I must admit, it's something of a tragedy.
Absolutely.
So we are gathered here together, Roy Field, for the latest edition of The Things That Made England. Things That Made England is about our love of the country that, despite everything, we feel proud to be part of. And we discuss the things that put together make England what she is. None of those things individually are probably unique to England. Might be the odd thing, but that's not the point. The point is that you put them all together, they make England distinctive. No doubt that will lead to another definition discussion. But the thing about our program is that it's like the British Constitution. The British Constitution is flexible. And nobody knows what it means.
I'm actually going to put my headphones on because I don't want there to be audio bleed and then you're going to...
Well, nobody wants audio bleed.
No, not at all. All right, so let me just don my headphones.
Do you normally don things?
Yes.
Here, so I'm going to don my coat.
It depends how formal I'm feeling. Normally, actually, if the truth be known, I just put things on. But with you, I feel I need to don, David.
I think you're absolutely right, because, you know, it's a bit of class. Anyway, we're blathering, aren't we? So what are we here to talk about? This week, I am proposing to you, Roy Field, that the topic of allotments should go into the cabinet of what makes England.
More David Crowther's sex, basically. You know, you're throwing the sex at this podcast.
I suspect you might be a little bit right that this is in danger of becoming the things that David Crowther likes doing rather than the things that made England.
Well, to be fair to you, I think we need to bring our own personal passions into this. But, you know.
Yes.
For me, it's road signs. For you, it's allotments. So there we go.
Hi, good Lord. What an exciting pair of people. So, allotments. You think everybody, just in case everybody doesn't know what allotment is, I think there's sort of things that are called community gardens in the States. So these are bits of land provided for the common folk, for you, people like you, and people like me, Royfield. I was going to make a joke about that, but I couldn't quite find the right. Anyway, in order to grow vegetables to feed ourselves and our families, okay? So why am I proposing this, Royford? I can hear you asking that. Ask me why.
Okay, shall I formally ask?
Yeah, go on, man.
David, why are you proposing this, considering that many countries throughout the world have allotments? Why is this uniquely English?
Did I ask you to add all that other stuff on?
That is my want, sir, as your foil in this podcast.
All right, okay. So there are a few reasons. Firstly, I think allotments tie into four fundamental English characteristics. Okay.
Ooh, okay.
Yes. I'm going to tell you what those four characteristics are, and you're going to like them. I know.
A love of fish and chips is definitely number one.
It's not one of them, actually. Have you grown fish on your allotment?
No.
Desire for self-sufficiency and a long tradition of self-help. Okay. A love of the land and the countryside. Maybe a tendency beginning to decline a little bit, but I think still very strong. A love of gardening and a deep, deep connection between man and shed and increasingly between woman and shed. This is no joke, Royford. In England and Wales, the Allotments Act of 1925, okay? 1925 yeah. Allotments Act made it statutory in England and Wales, not Scotland or Northern Ireland, to make an allotment available to the local community. And that is a unique law. So when we're talking about other people doing it, they kind of do. None of them do it on the scale of that happens in England. Okay.
I'm going to say that that law, that right of English, of every Englishman to have an allotment, is falling somewhat into abeyance, though, isn't it? No, because these councils, it's on the statute books, but many councils just aren't living up to that.
That's not true. If they're asked, they have to provide it. And most councils have allotments. Well, every council have allotments. They don't have as many allotments as they used to do. But every council has allotments.
Yeah, just before you witter on, right, and I lose the will to live, right?
You could just go and make yourself a cup of tea and I'll just talk.
I think there is another trait, which is very English, which goes to this love of allotments, and that is fear, David.
Fear.
Whenever we are scared, which is closely aligned to self-sufficiency, but, you know, when the war is a-coming, allotment take up goes through the roof. During the 3-day week in the 70s,
yes,
allotments got a shot in the arm. It's when in uncertain times, which, as said, is closely aligned to self-sufficiency, we retreat to our allotments.
It is true. They are a haven. And on that point, let me take you on a little journey for my second reason as to why they should go in. Let me take you on a little journey. Okay, so you've gone to a town anywhere in England, Middle England, you know, you select the town and you're walking through a rather grubby alleyway along the backs of some terraced houses. The weather's a bit rubbish because, you know, the weather's a bit rubbish in England. And there's a general smell of cabbage because we like overcooking cabbages. Then on your right, there's a little gap in the fence and you go step through it and you step into a world of green vitality and order. Neatly divided plots, subdivided many times, rows of bean canes, wonky sheds, improvised lean-tos, bits of plastic bottle being used to capture slugs or hold up nettle. You've entered a world of order connected to our roots, to 1,000 years of our ancestors breaking the sod, Royfield, breaking the sod and bringing life from the land. I rest my case. As you know, I should go on. I've got a few more bits of information. But do you know what I mean? When you find a set of allotments in a town, it's an oasis of beauty.
It's not an oasis of beauty.
Come on. There's nothing more beautiful on God's earth than a nicely well-ordered allotment.
David, in theory, it's a beautiful thing that every person can go and till their little plot of urban land and have ill-formed marrows growing there. And as you said,
talk about your own marrow, mate. My marrow is very nicely formed.
But you look out when you're travelling on the train in South London. It goes past many of an allotment, and it isn't a scene of visual beauty.
It isn't.
It's utter chaos and craziness with wonky sheds, discarded Wellington boots, all of that malarkey.
That's so inventive, isn't it? You know, everybody uses the other little bit of that old stuff. As I say, the cutting the tops off plastic bottles so that you can use them to put your netting over the end of your poles or whatever. It's fantastic. It's really, really inventive.
It says something about the invention of us English. But I'm just telling you, visually, it's not a beautiful sight. You know, your breast doesn't fill out with pride, you know, with nationalistic pride when you look at an allotment. It doesn't.
The thing is, your breast, if I may talk about your breast, Royfield, It's filled by some very strange things. I mean, for example, you think the flag of St. George is a piece of rotten design, which is just a bit odd.
It's very poor. Very poor design.
What's wrong with it? Anyway, a thing of beauty. Mm. So, a little bit of history, because I know you like it when I talked about history.
Well, the Marxist in me is about to get very upset about the reason why we have allotments in the first place. Oh, but anyway.
So, and the Marxist in me will join you in that. Which town in England has the first real evidence of allotments?
Birmingham.
Whoa, well done. 1732, there's an etching which come from the Guinea Gardens in 1720 to attract rural poor to come to Brum. And, you know, generally speaking, you need a bit of attraction to come to Brum. Ha, ha, ha. And that's kind of the first thing. I read some articles saying its roots are in the, you know, Anglo-Saxon times, but I think that's probably twaddle. When it really happens is the bit where we're going to get both annoyed, okay? Give me one word that makes the Marxist in you furious, and I bet I've guessed the right thing. I've written it down.
Well, it's the Enclosures Act, enclosures. Isn't it?
Absolutely right. And actually, that starts earlier than the Enclosure Act, which is, what, 19th century. In the 15th and 16th centuries, there's enclosure. So that the way that many parts of England were organised, though not all by any means, was an open field system where a lot of rural inhabitants had a very small amount of land, and the only way that they could live was by having common rights on the Lord's lands like woodland and open pasture, where they could then help make ends meet. And in the 15th, 16th centuries, a lot of this land is enclosed, and there are many enclosure riots. So suddenly you've got a world where, because of efficiency and growing commercialization, the poor no longer have rights and are no longer able to grow their own food. And so there's a problem. That is what you were going to get cross about, wasn't it?
Absolutely.
Outrageous robbery. Although truth's probably a bit more complicated than that. But let's not spoil a good story. So 1760, discussion, right, we need to give land to help the rural poor because they're poor, it would help reduce crime and immorality. That's another good argument for allotment. Immorality. You try it and I bet you'll become a good deal less immoral, all right? Not that I'm saying you're immoral now, you know, but we have been talking about your breasts. So it would reduce the amount of poor relief that was necessary, which was probably closer to the truth, wasn't it? You know, the gentry don't like giving money to people. It would provide incentives to patriotism if people had a stake in the land. I've never tried to grow steak on my own allotment, but you know what I mean? God, it's a terrible joke, isn't it? It would help stem the flow of people to industrial towns. So keep them in the countryside rather than pouring into the towns, which, of course, in the 18th century is just a phenomenon they don't understand. You know, how can this be?
But wait on a minute, David. I thought the whole point of allotments was to get people into urban centres, but so they could be somewhat self-sufficient.
Well, initially, absolutely not. It was to keep them in the countryside. But this is the 18th century. These are the early days of industrialization. You know, people don't really understand what's going on. Napoleonic War, that really starts the first wave of allotments off because there were really poor harvests. And old Boney was, what was old Boney doing to us?
Giving us a proper kicking.
Giving us a proper kicking. And he was telling all the continent they couldn't trade with us.
Absolutely.
So what do you call that? A blockade.
His continental system.
Continental system. Exactly right. So everybody has to grow their own food. And you're right that war encourages the growth of allotments. I'm going to cut this short because, you know, this is obviously getting a bit dull, but it's really the 19th century.
David, the topic started off as being dull. And you're doing nothing to alleviate the dullness here, sir. I'm telling you. Right.
So 1830s, economic problems again, massive population growth, industrialization. So we get something called the Labourers' Friend Society. And then so we get all the way to the 1920s and 30s, where allotments were now part of every Englishman and every Welshman's right. As we said, the 1925 allotment.
So, David, are you passing over the Small Holdings and Allotments Act of 1908?
That's very good. That is excellent. Tell me about the Smallholders and Allotments Act.
Well, if you don't see that this seminal act under Bonner Law in 1908 was important in the allotment movement, I will add nothing more to this other than to say I've done my research.
I was seeking, you know, to shorten this debate because, you know, so many acts about allotments, you know, and keep your audience. The audience is currently making a nice cup of tea. So by 1873, there are about 250,000 plots, By 1913, there are 600,000 plots. By the end of World War One, though, there were 1.5 million plots. The reason is pretty obvious, isn't it?
Yes.
And what is the largest number and the date of allotments in the UK? When did that happen?
Okay, I'm going to say...
Go on.
It's either going to be run up to World War II or just after World War II. I'm going to say just after World War II, and I'm going to say 1.5 million.
Close, 1.75. Absolutely right. For victory, 1945, 1.75 allotments. 75 million. So again, war, as you say.
But also, rationing is rationing as well.
So that's a little bit of history. Of course, now interest fell off dramatically. There are now about 330,000 allotment plots in the UK. Actually, most places apparently have demand and waiting lists, though not in our place, I have to tell you. So, Royford, if you want to nip over to my place and start an allotment, we have one available for you. It's got your name on it.
I will not be taking you up on that, but thank you anyway. I'm going to let you into a little bit of a truth here. What allotments mean to me are the late 1970s, going with my dad quite happily to his allotment.
Oh, yeah, your dad had an allotment.
Yeah, he had an allotment, and him digging stuff up. And I was just a chocolate spoon. I was too young to be of any use. But he'd bribe me by saying he'd buy me a comic on the way and a couple of chewy sweets. And I'd just run up and down like a headless chicken whilst he, tilled the soil for an hour or so. And it was absolutely a highlight of my childhood, you know, going with my dad to the allotment.
Good. Excellent. So I think your dad's obviously done a great job there, because gardening, I would have thought, to children, by and large, is as dull as ditch water. So if he's managed to get you involved in any way whatsoever, that's pretty good.
Well, he was smart. He said he'd buy me a comic on the way. He wasn't stupid.
Yeah.
Right. So
the other thing actually does for English people is it gives them a safe place to make contact with other people. So although allotments, in a sense, is about escape, it is also about connection, because you go down there, you've got something to talk about. It's something safe, like the weather. And I think it's a great way for people to get together by a shared hatred of aphids, for example. You know, we can all get together and hate aphids, can't we? The one problem actually I found with allotments is that it's a very public form of gardening.
I suppose that must be the real problem with an allotment, because you can clearly see how everybody else is getting on. There are no very walls public. Between
all allotments. Your mess-ups are exposed to the world. Mm.
You haven't really explained why this is uniquely English at all. This is, for me, sepia-tinged nostalgia, of which I'll readily sign up for normally.
But not this time. I don't think it is, actually. I mean, the number has decreased, but actually in many allotments, especially in towns, there's normally a waiting list for allotment plots, and the type of people that do it is now very diverse. I mean, in some cases that's a bit annoying, because you know, lots of brogue wearers are now coming down to allotments as well, but it's one of those activities which is pretty blind to race, religion, creed, sex and all the rest of it. You know,
I don't know if that's really true, and this isn't one of my arguments against it, but to me, bear in mind, my Jamaican-born father had an allotment, so maybe I'm arguing completely and utterly against myself. But anecdotally, putting my father to one side, there's a certain type of English person, which invariably is male, who is middle-aged and red of face, right, that seems to be into allotments.
We've got no red faces down our allotment, Royfield, I can tell you that. Where I live in Nettlebed is not the most racially diverse part of the world, but certainly gender-wise, it's very mixed indeed. It's certainly the older person. You're not getting many young people there, it's got to be said. But, in other ways, I think it's very mixed activity, because I think it ties into our desire now for greater quality rather than quantity. That whole thing about food ties very much into growing your own veg and having organic veg and having, you know...
Got a question for you, right? Because I'm not going to get an allotment anytime soon, let alone plant
anything.
Come and
share mine, Royfield.
You're all right. You're all right, sir. You don't want me coming down to your allotment. The one thing I would say, the spirit of councils having facility for people to take on an allotment is there, if only in the price that you pay. It's something like £25 a year to have an allotment. So it's totally a nominal fee, and councils lose money on allotments. So, it, you know, it's seen as a, you know, a civic good. How much food can you really grow in an allotment?
Sorry, how long have you got?
A podcast length.
So it's very seasonal. You know, you get, suddenly you've got billions of carrots and you can space it out a bit and have several plantings and all that sort of thing. But also in winter, it's, you know, you've got far fewer crops that will, you know, and normally they're disgusting, like sprouts, which of course, as you know, are inedible. So, you know, I think it would be certainly nobody would claim that you can really feed your family with your allotment, but it can make a very significant impact. It's about the love of it. It's about the connection with other people. That's what it's all about. Turning the sod, Royfield.
So what about flowers?
Flowers are quite common. Grow things like sweet peas, which are very expensive to buy, help manure your patch, smell beautiful, attract pollinators, and you can take home to the wife or indeed the husband. So there's a bit of flower, quite a bit of flower growing, but it's far, far, far smaller than vegetable growing, I'd say.
Well, yeah. David, because you're so passionate about this and because actually I quite like you, right, I might just give you a pass and put it in. But I haven't spent enough time in the former Soviet Union or in Sweden or these other countries to remark upon how impactful their system of allotments actually were into their societies. But when I proposed HP Source, whether you are the queen down to the poorest man in the street, you're touched by HP. I would contend to you, sir, considering that urban city living is the thing, and many a young person is flocking to London, it wouldn't surprise me if there are the whole swathes of young English people, women and men, that are not aware that an allotment is even a thing. That for me, I'm looking in the rearview mirror of English history, and this is just a thing, you know, on the road as we whiz by. Allotments are dying off in terms of the amount of people that have them. I have somewhat of a fond affection for them because it's about me spending time with my dad. But I don't know how.
Okay, I'm going to say three things. One of them which will agree with you. So actually, I found my facts. The other big country in the world that does allotments is Germany. Okay, mm-hmm. Who has 1.4 million allotments apparently, and we're then second. Netherlands very keen on them as well. But then it really drops off. So there are other countries that do it, but you know we're very much at the forefront of it. I agree with you though that the in absolute number terms, you know, this is a corner of English distinctiveness. I'm sure you're right. There are many people who would be very surprised to learn about allotments. But in terms of increase or decrease, no, I think at the moment the demand is very strong. There's a demand for 100,000 allotments we don't have. So I don't think it's on the way down. Actually, I think it's on the way up. So partly right, Royfield. What I'm arguing is that there's a part of the English psyche which absolutely is contingent with allotment gardening. And allotment gardening is far more important in England than it is in the vast majority of countries outside around the world.
Though not exactly. Germany.
Germans love it.
The Germans love it. And in Berlin alone, there are over 800 allotment complexes. You said we're the only one who's got it as part of legislation. No, there was a communist country and I went Czechoslovakia. And then I did a cheeky Google whilst you were bloviating about marrows and the Soviet Union brought
in
laws.
Yeah, but you're struggling around for one or two extra countries. I think it just proves my point.
What do you mean? I've done Germany, Russia, and what was the other one?
Two and a bit then, out of 167 countries. Right, you know.
Well, there's 192 countries in the world. But anyway, go on.
I think that demonstrates my point. Allotment gardening is far more important to English than it is to 99% of other countries around the world. There we go. Well, we can let the people decide, can we not?
I think it's about time that one of the things that we proposed did not make it into the cabinet. And
flag
I'm hoping...
Flag of St. George didn't make it.
That you're going to draw the short straw on this, David.
Well, I must admit, it is, you know, I accept it's a contentious thing, and I no doubt lots of people will come back and talk about community gardens in the US of A. And let's see what happens.
Ooh, I'm excited. For the first time ever, I'm truly excited to see a poll result, because I got a sneaky feeling you might lose this one.
It's been a long, difficult life, clearly, for you, Royfield. And the first time you've got excited, you've had a lot of gardens. Right, very good. Good chat. Thank you. I put it to the people to decide. A lot of gardens it is. And then before we go, Luke is going to sum up from the debate about Radio 4. And here we go. Over to you, Luke.
Well, you're an ornery lot, aren't you? When I heard that Royfield and David were doing Radio 4, I felt certain that we would be waving the illustrious station into the cabinet and moving on to debate which of its programmes is the most English of all, or maybe giggle at its vain attempts at diversity as it shoehorns in the odd regional accent to announce that we would now be visiting Ambridge. But oh no, not at all. Radio 4's position in the cabinet is about as strong and stable as Theresa May's position as Prime Minister. We're almost facing a hung parliament situation here. The measly 46 votes for it being an exemplar of all things English and good pretty much needs Amy's DUP-like support, with the 5 votes for her option that it must be English because she didn't get 99% of the references, for Radio 4 to squeeze some sort of majority. Arraigned against these votes, we had 2 votes for Catherine's desire to cover the whole of the BBC. 26 people wanted to sit it out as they have never listened, and 14 votes for Ben's option that Radio 4 is British, not English. I have it from the horse's mouth that there is no can of worms that Ben has ever left unmolested. And actually, that was precisely where much of the debate hinged. The old, is it British or is it English, splitting of hairs. Fiona and David had what Radio 4 might call a bit of a ding-dong on this one. Stuart and Alison had a very interesting discussion about how the influence of radio and the mostly received pronunciation that it uses has contributed to the loss of diversity of regional accents. And for this reason, Radio 4 is very much a thing that made England. Tom gave us a glimpse into how little British English has influenced the American vernacular by admitting that he had not realised that we call the last letter of the alphabet Z. Glenn picked this up and ran with it and asked what we called soda pop. As is often the case, Glenn, this might be regional. I would call it a fizzy drink, but my friend from Sheffield also calls it pop. If you want more about regional variations, look no further than Alison Mary's post on all the different names for a rounded piece of baked dough. There seemed to be a lot of love for In Our Time amongst our listeners. Well, everyone that is, except Mark's mum, who has a mysterious dislike for Melvyn Bragg. And I suppose you'd expect a certain overlap between listeners of a podcast like The Things That Made England and the spoken word output of Radio 4. We like some intelligent chat, don't we? I'd recommend popping over to the Facebook site to see some of the favourite shows of the like-minded, and as many of them are now available as podcasts, you can listen to them wherever you are, even if you are not a BBC licence payer. And for what it's worth, the BBC licence fee is right up there as my top tax. But don't you dare not come back to the loving arms of David and Royfield post the festive season for some more Things That Made England. Well, as we are about to allow David and Royfield a Christmas break, I will take this opportunity to wish you all a very merry Yuletide. As ever, I will be partaking in a most English festivity, with its heavily German-inflected traditions brought to us by Prince, with a Z, Thomas, Albert of Saxe-Coburg und Gotha. We'll sit down for a meal consisting of a bird from the Americas, named after a country in Asia Minor, trimmed with sprouts from Brussels, eek, and potatoes from Peru, with lots of little side options, including delights from Turkey and nuts from Brazil. This will all be washed down with gallons of wine from anywhere but here, and maybe a snifter of our very own port. Yes, I know port is from Portugal, but it was the English that put it on the map. My children will be visited in the dead of night by a jolly old man, nothing creepy about that, bedecked in the livery of a soft drinks company from Atlanta, whose mythology traces back to a Greek bishop, and will sit round a tree from a Norwegian wood to open our presents. What, after all, could be more English than this kind of mash-up of things from all over the world? Happy Christmas, one and all.
Thank you very much, Luke. Perfect as always.
However, Luke did of course spill the beans. We've not actually told the world we're taking a break. Cats, bags, all that sort of thing. But Royfield and I think we'll be back with something amazing, of course, around the 27th of January or so. So, have a great Christmas and New Year, everyone. And meanwhile, hit that Facebook site and vote allotment. Anyway, back to Royfield.
Nice talk to you, Rolf. Nice talk to you, Rolf.
Mr. Addis.
Nice talk to you, Royfield. And we'll let the people decide. Smashing. Bye, everybody.
And these are the things that made England.
And St. George!
These are the things that made England.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit EnergyCitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.